Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here in New York is Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. Matt, hello.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm very excited. We are getting kind of close to spring training, even though it feels like there's still so much more offseason left. And there's a couple things that I think we can talk about this week that I think are pretty interesting. We put a little bit of a StatCast spin on it. We're going to get to the Hall of Fame in a second because it's obviously big news. We can try to put a little bit of a StatCast angle on that, even though it's a lot more difficult than you might think. But I think kind of the news this week is that the Mariners never, ever stop making trades. We've been on the air for like 45 seconds, and there's probably been like three more trades. And so there's a couple of questions, I think, that I have based on the moves that they've made, over the last couple of days and even over the entire offseason. Are they good? Are they a contender? Like, they have made 25 different trades, and what's the outcome of this, right? So that's one question, and then we can also, I think, really focus on some of the outfield defense because that's a big move for them. And obviously, here at StatCast HQ, outfield defense is something we're putting a lot of effort into. So your top line opinion on the Seattle Mariners, what are they right now?
The Mariners are good. Okay. They're a contender in that division. And you said 25 trades, just to clarify. It's actually been 11 trades this offseason. No other team in Major League Baseball has made more than six. The Padres and Braves have each made six trades. The rest of the AL West has combined for 10 trades. So one fewer than the Mariners, and the Angels have made five of those. So just to give you a little context on that front. I know Mike is prone to hyperbole.
I thought I was making it clear that wasn't a real number. It was a lot of trades.
I think they're a good team. Richard Justice wrote a good column about this last night for MLB.com, basically how Jerry Dipoto has kept his core intact and just kind of tinkered around the edges. And I think they've developed they're a deeper team. And they have a lot of pieces that fit together pretty well. I think there's one more move they should make. We can get to that in a second. But I think this is a team that is in position to contend with the Astros and definitely the Rangers. The Astros may be the favorite, but the Astros have pitching questions. I think the Mariners are right there with them.
Yeah, they've completely revamped that outfield, right? If you look at the outfield right now, it stands left field looks like Jerod Dyson and Ben Gamel. And Ben Gamel came over from the Yankees last year. Center field, Leonis Martin and some Jerod Dyson. And then right field, a combination of Mitch Haniger and Nelson Cruz and maybe Danny Valencia. Mitch Haniger is kind of a guy they got from Arizona for the Taiwan Walker deal. He's sort of a breakout star amongst a lot of people who I respect. They really think he can hit. They think the defense is there. He's maybe a center fielder playing right, and if that's true, then they might have three center fielders in the outfield because Jerod Dyson is obviously a fantastic outfielder. If you've seen us on Twitter, we've been kind of tweeting out these speed line charts that show how many catches or missed catches did an outfielder have that were considered easy or hard or highlight, etc. Jerod Dyson made seven highlight catches last year, did not allow a single easy ball to drop in. That's impressive to me.
Yeah, no, Dyson is one of my favorite players in baseball. He's just going back to the wild card game when he did his little rev the engine thing after he stole third base. We did a backflip after catching the final out of a game in the pennant race. That guy's awesome. He'll be a useful piece for them. Haniger, I'm not sold on. You know, he's very old for a quote-unquote prospect, relatively speaking, of course. I think he's already 25, going to be 26 this year. So I'm skeptical, and that's why I think – the Mariners should be signing Jose Bautista.
So here's the part where I think Matt and I disagree, which is kind of cool because we're usually on the same page about a lot of this stuff. I think we're in agreement that this is a go-for-it-right-now team, right? Robinson Cano is over 30. Felix Hernandez is, I think, 31 this year and, you know, didn't look like the same ace that he was. Nelson Cruz is 37, I think. Kyle Seager, underrated star in his prime. This is the time to go for it. We're in agreement on that. Where I'm not so sure about Jose Bautista is where he would fit on this team, because you've already got Nelson Cruz, who is a righty DH outfielder who can't really play the field, and you've got Danny Valencia, who is a righty first base sort of outfielder who's probably best suited as a DH. Is there not some redundancy by adding Jose Bautista there?
I just think he's better than what they have. He's an upgrade. I think that I'd rather have him on my roster than Valencia or Haniger. He's definitely better than one of the. He will definitely be better than one of the two of them, and in that case, well, the other one becomes expendable either via minor league options or going to the bench, what have you. Bautista is going to give you high OBP. You can play him at first base. You can play him a little bit in the outfield. So he actually has some versatility. And I think when we're seeing the teams now in Major League Baseball that succeed, it's having that kind of depth to be able to move some pieces around. And while he's not versatile in like a Javier Baez, you know, Ben Zobrist sense, you can put him in enough places that he's not going to be just like a dead spot on your roster. And with the Mariners, I know we'd have to cost them a first-round pick, but this is a team that already has sort of like pushed all their chips in to compete for the next year or two, and I think he's an upgrade on that roster. And I worry that putting too much faith in Mitch Haniger, a 26-year-old rookie, essentially, is that's risky.
What I like about Bautista, and I wouldn't like this if I was a fan of the team that's going to sign him, is you can use the StatCast numbers to put some actual data to the eye test. And what I mean by that is, so when I first moved to New York 2007, like the first year or two I was here, I got really good seats at Yankee Stadium behind the third base dugout. And he was playing third base that day. And I remember watching him and going, wow, this guy is an absolute cannon, like a total rocket. And then we saw that in the outfield for a number of years. He was just destroying guys from right field. The last year or two, it has not really seemed like that. And I know he hurt his shoulder in 2015. And when you look at the numbers, and unfortunately I don't have him in front of me, he had an enormous drop in arm strength. That he was down into the mid-80s last year. For context, Starling Marte, I think, was number one on our list at 97 miles an hour. Mid-80s is pretty low for an outfielder, and I think we saw that with Bautista. The arm is not what it was. The range is not what it was. I would question him being in the outfield too much.
Agree with you, but I'm and for me, it's a part-time role for him. You know, I think he's more first base, some outfield, a little bit of DH. He'd be the highest OBP guy on the team, perhaps. Like, I'd almost hit him leadoff on that team.
You know where he should be? The New York Mets. Different conversation,
Another player that the Mariners acquired, interesting from a StatCast perspective, is Drew Smyly.
I've been a big Drew Smyly fan for a couple years.
Yeah, I think last year you wrote kind of the definitive Drew Smyly piece.
Sort definitive.
Of predicting his breakout for the Rays last year.
Yeah, that didn't go so well. He came over in the deal, the David Price deal, from Detroit a couple years ago. And that deal was very unpopular amongst Rays fans. And then he had a pretty good first year in Tampa, although he was hurt. And that's always been his issue. He always gets hurt. But what I had written entering last year is that he was elite, like Max Scherzer level elite at plate appearances ended with strikeouts or pop-ups, which are essentially strikeouts. He missed bats. He did it from the left side. And that's because he's got a very high vertical movement on his fastball. He's got a good spin rate on his fastball. That didn't work last year in any way. He actually had an ERA of like 4.5, gave up way too many home runs. The strikeouts were down. And I think that was kind of an epidemic among the Rays staff. We're going to talk about Tampa Bay in just a second, but a very bad year for him. So you're saying that you like him in Seattle because A, I'm assuming the ballpark is much better suited for a fly ball pitcher, and B, the outfield defense should be fantastic. On the other hand, he did have Kevin Kiermaier behind him last year, so there's that. But if they have the combination we talked about, that's three very good outfielders.
Well, and it's also that I think this is part of what GM Jerry DePoto did a good job of, is that I didn't really like when he traded away Taiwan Walker because I still think that there's a lot of upside there, and I thought that he kind of sold low on Walker and bought high on Gene Segura. But he was able to bring back sort of a guy not similar to Walker in terms of repertoire, but similar in that kind of like the kind of guy who's still young and has some upside. So basically he got rid of one guy who sort of had this, you know, number two starter potential, but in another similar kind of, like, I wouldn't say minor deal, but mid-level deal, he brought in another guy who sort of fits that bill. It's like, okay, here's a guy in a rotation who might actually be a breakout and be much better than we think he's going to be. So he was able to bring in Segura, who's probably an upgrade for them, even though I'm not sure what to think of him.
It was a very Babbitt-y year last.
Yeah, but then he sort of filled the quote-unquote void by bringing in Smyly without actually giving up anything that would necessarily hurt the roster significantly for 2017.
Yeah, and the last thing on Seattle, I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago over the holidays about five breakout pitchers. And I remember we had an internal conversation about what actually was a breakout pitcher. I consider James Paxton to have had his breakout, and you and the Twitter poll I put out kind of argued against, and I guess that's because he had like a 7-9 record and an ERA over 4 or whatever. But I really like James Paxton, one of three lefties to hit 100 miles an hour last year, Chapman being one of the other two. And if you look at his last 3 years, he had 2014 and 2015 through about 70 innings, had about a 19% strikeout rate, 9% walk rate. Last year, doubled the innings to 120, increased the strikeout rate up to 23%, and halved the walk rate. That is an incredibly good sign to me.
Yeah, he's the guy that's going to be on all the the fantasy list this year of you know, the I don't know if he's quite a post type sleeper, but he was a big prospect a couple years ago.
So stay healthy.
You know, I mean, you look at the rotation: Felix Hernandez, James Paxton, Iwakuma, Smyly, Gallardo. That Gallardo trade was kind of weird.
I'm not a big fan of Gallardo,
but he's our number five starter, basically. I like Seth Smith, but he is a platoon player. I thought the Orioles did well on that deal, but Gallardo's your number five starter. You know, Edwin Diaz, Cishek, Repchinski. It's a deep team.
Yes,
and I think that's, we're seeing teams succeed with depth. And the Stars and Scrub models, it's harder and harder to pull off. And they were kind of a Stars and Scrubs team 2 years ago. And DePoto, with like tinkering around the edges, he's kind of kept their stars. Granted, he's counting on some stars in their 30s to continue like a high level performance.
Deeper and more athletic.
So
and you're right. Stars and scrubs rarely works. The Diamondbacks tried that, didn't work. The White Sox have tried that for a couple of years. Now look where that ended up. Let's move all the way across the country to a team that is just stocked of ex-Mariners, because these two teams make trades constantly. Tampa Bay Rays. Tampa Bay Rays were involved in the sort of pseudo three-way trade that they made with Atlanta yesterday. So Malik Smith, who's an outfielder, went from Atlanta through Seattle, now ended up in Tampa Bay, and that's how Drew Smyly ended up in Seattle. I thought that was really interesting because if you look at the Rays last year, they were an incredibly flyball pitching staff. And what I mean by that is if you look at the percentage of batted balls that stayed in the park, not home runs, that went at least 250 feet with a launch angle of 25 degrees or more, so roughly fly balls to the outfield that weren't home runs, Tampa Bay's percentage of those batted balls, number one. They gave up the most. If you just look at the raw total, they had 708 such batted balls. That's number three in baseball. Maybe they'll go down a little bit without Drew Smyly, who contributed to that certainly. But this is a team that likes to get fly balls to the outfield. Kevin Kiermaier is their center fielder. Kevin Kiermaier, arguably the best defensive center fielder in baseball. If not, he's at least in the conversation. This was actually, I thought this was really interesting. This is from a mailbag that our own Rays beat writer Bill Chastain wrote. He broke his hand last year and he was out for a little while. When he did, the Rays were 20-19 without him, 14-35, including a stretch of 3-22. That's a big deal. I mean, that says a lot about how important he is.
When you look at these like the defense range charts that Mike was talking about, which you can access yourself on Baseball Savant on the player pages, looking on
for outfielders.
If you go on an outfielder's player page on Baseball Savant, you can see their defense charts. You can see basically a plot of all the catches they made based on hang time versus distance they had to travel to make it. You also see all the hits they allowed. So you can compare kind of when they've allowed easy hits versus...
Yeah, and that's brand new, by the
like,
way.
It's like a week old.
As of a couple of days ago. So you can make any of these your one. It's very cool.
But the point is, Kiermaier, like, his chart's amazing, even though he had limited playing time last year. And then you go and look... When we go look at the... For some of the... speed leaderboards and base time, like, you know, first to second, home to second, you know, on a double speed board, Kiermaier comes up. Kiermaier, he can throw the ball 9,500 miles, but from a Statcast perspective, he's
not a five-tool player because of the bat, but he's pretty close, right? He does a lot of other stuff good.
I'm starting to think he's underrated. Is, you know, sort of when you look at that stat, I'm starting to think that Kiermaier, people talk about the Rays as kind of a sleeper team as being competitive, I think it might actually be because Kevin Kiermaier may actually be like a 6 or 7 win player, and we don't think of him that way.
Quick sidebar here. As you may know, I just went to MLB Network and filmed the top 10 leaderboards at every single position with myself, Bill James, Brian Kenny, and Vince Gennaro. And so we did our top 10 at every single position. Center field was by far the deepest. There was like 18 guys I wanted to get in the top 10. I put Kevin Kiermaier number 3, and everybody else looked at me like I was out of my mind. I don't even think he made everybody's top 10 list. And part of the reason is exactly what you just said. I do think he's underrated. The bat's never going to be a superstar, but he's a league average hitter. Yeah. You know, he had double digits home runs and steals last year, and with that glove, that's a star. That's, like you said, 5, 6, 7 win player right there. I was higher on him than anybody. I'm going to get a lot of pushback for that. I already regret leaving Jackie Bradley off my list. That might have been crazy, but it's such a deep position. I do agree with you. He's a total superstar, and now what they've done is they've added actually 2 outfielders in the last couple of days. They added Malik Smith, and they added Colby Rasmuth. So I don't know if Malik Smith can actually hit or not, and he's only like 23 years old. Still has a lot to prove, but he played a lot for Atlanta last year, especially when Ender Inciarte was hurt before Malik Smith got hurt himself. He played center field pretty consistently for a couple months. He only missed one easy ball last year, one ball that we classified as easy, and it was really, I looked at it yesterday, it's one of my favorite plays because it just says so much about what we're going to be able to do with this data. If you watch the play, you see him, it's a Justin Turner double. He comes running full speed, makes this really like all-out diving play, gets his hands on it, and just misses it. And you watch the video, and you're thinking, easy? How in the world is that, Paul? Easy? He barely just got there. But when you look at the data, he started 75.8 feet away from the ball. He ran 90.7 feet to get to the ball. And what that says is that was a really atrocious route. He added 15 extra feet he did not need. And if he hadn't done that, if he had just gone in a straight line, probably makes that ball without even a dive. So I thought that was really cool. And that's going to kind of show you the way that things that maybe look easier hard aren't necessarily true.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other outfielder they added, sort of, I think was a nice buy low for them.
Yeah, Colby, 1 year, $5 million?
Yeah, Colby Rasmus, who's, you know, sort of basically... wrote, you know, like alternates between good years and bad years. Well, he just had a bad year, so, you know.
A really bad year.
Obviously going to have a good year now, right?
Well, there's a quick question. him or Brett Anderson, who was the worst ever guy who accepted the qualifying offer? Who provided the least value for their team for $15 million?
Yeah, it was. It didn't go so well for Rasmus last year in Houston, but he's, you know, you pulled up some Statcast data on him, I believe, or a little bit. He missed one easy play, but it was, and that's the thing that we're starting to realize. You know, as Mike says, it was looking at my notes that Mike gave me. he missed one easy play, but it was Green Monster related. And that's sort of what we've noticed too, is like I was admiring Kevin Kiermaier's chart, and I saw he missed one easy play too. I was like, oh, well, let me go look at this. And it was a ball hit by Jose Bautista, like a really like a moonshot in Rogers Center, that it was really hard to judge, and he sort of mistimed his leap at the wall. So it was like, it was certainly a catchable ball, but it wasn't easy by, like, we use these as broad classifications. When you watch the play, sometimes it's not as easy as it looks.
Well, I guess we should clarify. We're just considering this based on how distance away from the ball and hang time. Like, how far did you have to run, and how much time did you have to do it? And I think that gets us most of the way there, but there are some, you know, direction matters, how close you are to the wall matters. Those are not baked in yet. It's absolutely something that will be, you know, in a version 1.5 or version 2 soon enough, but for right now, it's still kind of just this is a beta thing we have, which is really cool, and it's close enough, I think. But yes, there are some things like that that need to be smoothed out. But this is interesting, I thought. He only missed the one easy play, which is great. He doesn't mess up a lot of really gimmies, and some of the lower-rated outfielders will make a lot of stupid mistakes, but he did not make any true outstanding plays. There was nothing in there that was like, this is a highlight. And so that's kind of a question I think we're going to have to ask ourselves going forward, is what's more important, making these really great plays or just not screwing up the easy ones? Obviously the best outfielders do both, but which one of those weighs more to you?
I'm sort of on the I don't think there's anything more demoralizing than botching an easy play. So I am I think that botching an easy play is making all the easy plays is more important to me.
I'll buy that. And, you know, it's a fun tool, is if you look at the charts we have now, and you can see if a guy missed an easy play, and sometimes it's like right on the line, okay, that's not bad. And sometimes he misses an easy play, and you can see it's like way up into the color-coded blue easy section, and you're like, oh, that must have been awesome. And then you watch the video, and it's like, loses it in the sun, trips over his own feet, crashes into the shortstop. You can make your own blooper reel, almost. So anyway, I think the Rays will be interesting, because they're still going to have a fly ball staff, but they should have much better outfield defense, right?
They're always a team, you know, Jonah Carey, extra 2%, you know, playing around the margins. They have, you know, a really, you know, hardcore analytics team. I don't think they're going to, you know, win more games than the Red Sox, but the Rays being in the wild card race is totally feasible.
I agree with you, and yet I also think they'll be the best last place team in baseball.
There's also that, too. They're, by the way, we didn't plan this, but they're actually another place where Jose Bautista
absolutely. No, without question. That is the number one place for me. I can't think of a better place for him to fit. He could play DH there. He could play, I can't even remember who's their first baseman these days. Logan Morrison still, or is he a free agent? That was last year. Who even knows? But that's the point, is yes, they have opportunities there. And I think that would be a really, really good spot for him.
One more topic to hit for the show.
Hall of Fame's coming up.
Yes.
Today's Wednesday the 11th, I think.
No, today's Thursday.
Today's Thursday. Listen, I can't keep track of any days. We both have small children. Who even knows what days it is? Next Wednesday will be the announcement of the Hall of Fame voting. Obviously, all ballots were due in on December 31st. And due to the great Hall of Fame tracker run by Ryan Thibodeau, we've been able to kind of keep track of who is trending in or out. Right now, it seems like Jeff Bagwell and Tim Raines are slam dunks. And Ivan Rodriguez, Vladimir Guerrero, and Trevor Hoffman are all kind of pretty close. You could see all or none of them getting in. Bonds and Clemens are going to do better than ever, but I don't think they're going to get in. So it seems like we're going to have between 2 and 5 inductees this year, which is cool, right? It's better than we've had 0 in the past.
Yes.
So I'm happy about that. But, you know, Matt came up with a good idea. We can't really go back to these guys' careers and put Statcast numbers to them, right? Where we're starting to do that for current stuff, like in the NL Cy Young voting, I know people were looking at, you know, exit velocity for Kyle Hendricks, which is important. But we don't have this data going back for these guys, and it's kind of interesting. What of these guys, like, what was their skills? Would you really love to have Statcast data for? Like, what would change your opinion about them if you knew this or that about them? Like, it would be cool to say this guy was actually the best ever at doing this. We can't do that, unfortunately, but we came up with a couple of lists of guys we'd really like to see, you know, the numbers for specific things. You know, for me, the first one that stood out to me, Ivan Rodriguez, I would really love to know his pop time and arm strength. Now, if you look at the caught stealing numbers, 46% caught stealing. The average during his career was 31%. We also know that a lot of caught stealing has nothing to do with the catcher at all. It's the base runner. It's the pitcher. But for me, growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, the two catchers that really stood out to me in terms of arm strength reputation, Ivan Rodriguez and Benito Santiago.
For sure.
Just killing guys from his knees. I would love to know, did he throw harder than anybody? Did he get the ball out of his glove harder than anybody? We can't know that, but that would be so fascinating for me.
For sure. Yeah, no, he's definitely, you know, he... In his career, he was catching Nolan Ryan. I can't imagine Nolan Ryan was quick to the plate. So.
Right, exactly right. For kind of related, I want to know what Vlad Guerrero's arm strength was. Now, I know later in his career, his knees went, he wasn't a good outfielder, but when he first came up with the Expos and then early on with the Angels, he was making these kind of, I was like, Yasiel Puig gets compared to him for these absolute rockets from right field.
Well, he has that one iconic throw. I think it's in Toronto. I think it's Alberto Castillo, where he basically throws him out from like deep in right center field on a fly. I'm curious to know the throw distance. Like if we compare that to that throw that Puig made last year
in Colorado. Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of thing that would be, you know, be pretty awesome to be able to make that comparison.
You go to one of the pitchers, and yeah, I'm going out of order on my own notes here. Trevor Hoffman's like main out pitch was his changeup, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it was. I want to know what was so good about the changeup. Was it a very low spin rate? You know, was there something about the spin rate compared to his fastball or the way he released it? I mean, we can't know that, but I want to know why was his changeup so much better than anybody else's?
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable because he was a guy who was throwing, you know, 88 on his fastball and like 78 on his change, and he, you know, got 600 saves.
Was that true? His entire career was, he was never
when
really
he first when he first broke in, he was actually like 95. He was
kind of flamethrower,
but for most of his peak, he was like around 90 miles
People
an hour.
Forget, like the last year he had in Milwaukee was pretty poor, but the first year in Milwaukee before that was a very, very, very good year. And
yeah,
he was like 40 years old at that point.
It was like a 1.5 ERA.
And I'd be really interested to know the yearly exit velocity for Sammy Sosa. Just because he has had such an interesting career for a lot of reasons. He came up, didn't really have power for the first couple of years, and then had massive power. We know he had the corked bat thing and everything else that went into the Sammy Sosa experience. I'd really love to know if there actually was a change for any of these reasons from year to year, or if there wasn't. Maybe he actually just kind of hit the ball the same every year despite all these outside factors. I don't know. I would love to know that.
That'd be great. And then, you know, the other player you mentioned here, there's a couple of things. You brought up Tim Raines.
Yeah, that's why I left him for last, because I knew you had Tim Raines also.
Your Tim Raines thing would be?
Well, so Tim Raines stole 808 bases. He had 16 seasons where he stole 10 or more, topped out at 90 stolen bases in 1983. I want to know why, right? So you're on your list is, well, what was his raw speed? Was he faster than Vince Coleman? Is he faster than Ricky Henderson? Maybe. On my list, I want to know, did he have like incredible leads? Was he just really good at reading pitchers and turning 90 feet between the bases to 75 feet so he didn't even have to run as long? You know, maybe you could eyeball that from the video. I don't know, but it'd be so cool to have the data and say, why was he such a good base dealer?
For sure. You know, exactly. And, you know, that era that he played in was so synonymous with base stealing, you know. So I'd be really curious comparing him to, as you said, Coleman and Ricky Henderson.
That actually brings up another idea. I wish we had comparisons of speed for Ricky Coleman, Vince Coleman on that Busch Stadium turf as compared to like a grass field, you know, or dirt infields. I want to know how much impact that actually had on
his speed. That's a really good question. Another thing I was curious about as far as the Hall of Fame ballot, Curt Schilling and his four-seam fastball spin rate. You know, he threw hard, but he also got, it just seemed like he got a lot of swing and misses up in the zone, and he sort of fits the profile of someone who had a really high four-seam fastball spin rate, that sort of like deceptive rising fastball, but like I'm not sure.
He threw hard, but he was never sitting at like 99.
No.
You know, like, so it wasn't just velocity for him.
You know, his sort of, you know, the other guy in the bout most similar to Schilling in terms of career stats, Mike Mussina, famous for that knuckle curve. I want to know the spin rate on that knuckle curve and sort of compare it to other, you know, other curveballs of the air and know if spin rate was sort of the reason why he was so dominant. You know, on a very just basic level, I want to know how hard Barry Bonds hit the ball.
I mean, that's it right there, right? He's the best hitter who ever lived. How hard did he crush the ball?
But I also, you know, you wonder if he was more of just sort of like we've talked about before in terms of Bryce Harper, where Bryce Harper, when he had that MVP year, like in 2015, one of the interesting revelations was his raw exit velo was exceptional, but it wasn't like the best of the best. He was sort of in the second tier, and it was more about just being able to kind of get the perfect launch angle.
Yeah.
You know, he was able to barrel up the ball, but not hitting the absolute lasers where that, you know, that we see from Carlos Gonzalez and Mike Stanton.
My guess for Bonds is that he wouldn't be a Giancarlo Stanton where he's, you know, topping out at 120 miles all the time. But I think he probably was able to do it at the right angle with more consistency. Like if we had quote unquote barrels back then, I think he'd have been leading in that because he would have just done it so often every day in and out, where Stanton is not necessarily that consistent.
Yeah.
Lots of strikeouts, obviously.
Yeah, and the last guy I'd be curious about, just because of our infatuation with Coors Field, is Larry Walker. just examining his, you know, any of his key markers, exit velocity, launch angle, at Coors Field, away from Coors Field. I mean, he was another guy, extremely efficient base stealer, so I have to imagine, at least in his prime, have to imagine lead distance was a factor there. Also a great throwing arm when he was in his prime. In many ways, you know, we talk about five-tool players. There aren't actually that many five-tool players, because even Mike Trout, for example, doesn't have a great throwing arm. Whereas, like, Larry Walker, you know, one of the few legitimate guy hit for average, hit for power, throwing arm, running speed, defense, legitimate five-tool player. And sort of, you know, I kind of think that he's becoming the new Tim Raines, so to speak, the guy who's being, like, wildly underrated on Hall of Fame voting.
I think it's in part because the team he might be most well-known for is no longer in action. Since you brought up Coors Field, by the way, one other thing I would love to know, pre-humidor and post-humidor. I want to know if there were changes in spin rate and exit velocity and launch angle. I think it was, like, you know, 2002 or whenever they put that in, so we can't even know that. But I would love to know that. How cool would that be?
To the StatCast time machine.
That's exactly right. So the Hall of Fame voting comes out next Wednesday. Keep an eye out on MLB Network this Sunday night at 9 p.m. and 10 p.m. The second base and third base top 10 right now shows that I participated in will be airing. And that's it for our show this week. I'm Mike. He's Matt. Thanks for listening to the MLB.com StatCast podcast.